So, thank you, Tom, for this kind introduction. Yeah, I'm glad to be at the Field Institute and also to be able to address, as I understand, some experts from industry, and I guess in insurance, actuarial area, and other areas. So, what I'm trying to do here now in the following is to present some results, some views, which I have been also now bringing closer to the actuarial community for maybe the last year and a half. And there will be a number of things that I will unfortunately have to repeat for those who spent with me yesterday and also today, this morning. So I apologize, but there will be later other things, and maybe something is becoming clearer from that angle as I'm presenting it now, because I gave two workshops also yesterday morning and today's morning. So what is here happening? I was about, yes, almost 18 years ago, I was working with a leading investment bank. It was Bankers Trust, some of you may remember. It was the leading in derivative investment banking, and I wrote with my team, at that time, latest software technology to price barrier options and other things. It was very successful. And during that, I asked them finally, the colleagues there, what would you do when you have now really the task to price, say, a put option on an index which is having maturity 30 years out, or things like that? Or something which may be interesting for my guaranteed pension, or things like that? And the answer I got was not consistent with what my common sense told me. They, of course, as investment banker, wanted to use this relative pricing, this risk-neutral pricing, what they used all the time. But they used it mainly for 1 or 2 year, maybe 3 year was really long-dated options, but not 30 years. And when I was thinking, then this kind of hedge, which would come out, compared to what actually one could do, just thinking of the distribution, where more or less these index in 30 years may be, and the at the money is here now, there was a great discrepancy, and my common sense told me there must be a better way. That is just too expensive, what they want here. And was moving this question with me around, talked to my academic colleagues, so Martin Schweitzer and others, and there was no way. Some even didn't get the question in the way as I wanted to say it. But after a while, I was then more or less fascinated by that, and it took me quite a number of years. And a result is an approach which going beyond this investment banking, as a quantitative finance risk-neutral approach, which is relative pricing, and I called it benchmark approach. And there's a book, and this I really strongly recommend to anyone who wants to see more of what I'm presenting here. Otherwise, go to my webpage. It's a Quantitative Finance Research Center at the University of Technology in Sydney. There's one paper with Marquardt and Jaschke. These are leading actuaries from Munich Re in Munich, which is the largest reinsurer. And with them, when I explained this approach to them, this was more or less a working paper that came out. And some of it I will present today. And then I wrote, just at the end of last year, a paper, Real World Pricing of Long-Term Contracts, so more or less the title of that talk, which is summarizing in a very, I would say, in a way which I think, I hope so, is quite the right way of explaining it to, say, to actuaries and to other people who are more oriented towards insurance. So this is the literature, and for those who still may like to have another reference, there will be a book at Springer Verlag on numerical solution of stochastic differential equation with jumps in finance, and the chapter 3 is a really nice summary, I hope a nice summary of the benchmark approach, so that you can easily read through. The proofs are left out, and you see the core story in a compact way. So our goal will be to approach the question how we should handle the pricing of long-dated securities. Of course, the variable annuities, this is a very big market, and most of us have something in that area via maybe via the pension funds, via the insurance, or in some other way. So these variable annuities become more and more common. They are typically fund-linked, as a link to some kind of security. It could be your market index, your equity index. It could be CPI or other units where this is linked. In principle, from a finance point of view, it's just some kind of a payoff structure which involves some financial instruments, and typically it's an index. And then there will be guarantees in this, like a put type structure in such a fund in this payoff. And we will look at such a guaranteed minimum death benefit, which is one example, and there are so many range and so many other ways of structuring then the products. The problem is just to get the price right. And there is a really major discrepancy what actuaries in principle think and have learned in principle over hundreds of years in some way, and what, say, investment bankers today do. And we had the situation that at AIG there was a large group which did more or less credit instruments, so subprime, and we know what the result was. The actuaries had no access to that group, and those who wanted to criticize them, we find them now in court with AIG and others just to get more or less this kind of shutting up quite experienced people one should have heard to. And this is here a situation where we have more or less really a problem. The actuarial view and the healthy, also even common sense view, and what investment banking today still is doing, there is a contradiction, when, particularly when we go for the long term. So I'd like to resolve that, and we go a bit on here. There is, of course, a lot going on in the industry, and also we have not only the regulators, also a lot of CFO and CRO forums working, trying to resolve it. So from the industry side, then there are consultants, you know yourself, the leaders here in North America, and others who come up with reports and suggestions on what to do. So what I'm suggesting, and I try to explain it, it's rather simple at the end, and they are also common sense, but of course it takes a while, and to get it mathematically so precise that one can rely on it and has no gaps and loose ends anywhere, this is of course, this was I thought my task to do. So is this benchmark approach. So really the first papers which finally appeared in the literature start around 2002. There's a paper with Hans Bühlmann, so it's I think the most senior insurance expert in Switzerland. He's of course now retired, but Hans, when I talked about benchmark approach at a conference in finance in Switzerland, he came up, and I didn't know him before, but he became really my friend, and said this is a kind of thing where we actuaries really can see now how things come together, and this was also then the kind of stimulus that I got. And we wrote a paper in Austin Bulletin where you can find the benchmark approach in a discrete time version, because Hans said, but you can't explain to me in discrete time, then I don't believe too much. So what is the trick? What is the core idea? The idea is the following. You, everyone, and also of course an insurance company is having some kind of an investment universe. So maybe it's the equity market, maybe plus some other investment possibilities. So what the idea is now, formulate the, in whatever sense, and I will explain it later, the best performing strictly positive portfolio that you can create. So do that. Best performing will be made precise later, mathematically very clear. So take that. So what is then the idea already, what happens? When you take this and take it as numeraire, also as reference unit, denominate anything what you do, any cash flow, anything what you have in units of that, what will happen? It's best performing what you have used as denominator. So what will happen in principle over a time, on average, all these benchmark securities to make this best performing portfolio your benchmark, and benchmark by this, that means all your benchmark securities will have either no trends or in the long term maybe a downward trend because you had used the best performing portfolio as your numerator, as your reference unit. So there's some kind of a directional thing in your market now happening. The mathematicians say you get a super martingale property. So a martingale is a stochastic process where the current value is the best forecast of any of its future values. Super martingale is a stochastic process where its current value is greater or equal than the expected future values. Okay, a martingale is a very special super martingale, that is, which is having no trend, which is really then the fair situation. But the thing is, the classical theory, the risk-neutral pricing, allows in principle only models where everything, when put more or less on some risk-neutral measure in a discounted world, where there are no trends. These are all the martingales from your view. So what you are missing in the long term, you are missing in principle a possibility that some securities, when benchmarked or when denominated, may trend downward somehow. And this is important. In the short term, it doesn't matter because in the short term, everything looks like what we call martingales, and then the risk-neutral pricing is fine. But in the very long term, it matters very much. And why it matters? What we have, the main thing is we have our productive units, our industries, so they are more or less securitized via stocks, via equity. And look at an equity index, we know very well, there's clear empirical evidence, there is an equity premium. So above the fixed income in your economy, in your country, you get some premium as an investor for the stocks you hold. It's in the long term, of course, fluctuations and major market correction as we had now, this will happen. It comes again and again. But in the long term, takes the last century, 5%, and if you go back to the data, whatever we have, down to 1640 or so, you just see in the logarithmic scale, this equity index is always growing and growing and growing. So in the US, last century, about 5%, what was above interest rate, this kind of growth that you have. So there is a fact. The investors economically are stimulated to invest into stocks because in the long term there is an equity premium. So this means they like to be rewarded by that. And they will be rewarded if they wait long enough. The risk-neutral theory just is in principle only looking at whatever these diffusion coefficients, these fluctuations, these volatilities are doing, and don't care about drift. It's just the mechanics, how the mathematics works out there. So that means it's fine in the short term, one can hedge, and a certain form of arbitrage is then excluded if the model is assumed to be correct. But in the long term, there is no real fixing against the economy. So what risk-neutral pricing can do is relative pricing. So here is a price out there, maybe a subprime mortgage, and here is an option on an index, and so on. And then there are some traders who have some similar instrument, so they will interpolate more or less from these prices and calibrate their models such that you can hedge and between these instruments and get it in principle right. And they think it's fine. Because there is something what we call a law of one price, which one learns almost in the first class in economics or finance, and then they say, okay, since I can hedge, everything is fine. I will explain this is not our, it's a poor description of our world. It may be sufficient for 1 or 2 or 3 years, but if you go long out, 30 years or 80 years, this is not enough, because this equity premium is there, and you may have for one and the same payoff, two or more self-financing portfolios that replicate this payoff. Not throwing any money away, or it's really self-financing, and they are clearly different. What we only know is, from what I said at the beginning, we have used this best performing portfolio as our numerator, as our reference unit, so everything benchmarked will be a so-called super martingale. So what we know, all these self-financing portfolios are then super martingales, and some of them, the better ones for us, are the martingales that have no trends. And the pricing should be favorably by using these martingales, which in the cheapest way will give us the desired payoff. But then still in this market, they can exist, and they exist, other self-financing portfolios that are also super martingales, but not martingales. And a super martingale is a process that trends down, but it hits then the same payoff. So it comes from a higher level, so it's more expensive than this martingale, what I was talking about. And this effect can happen, and it happens in reality, and I will show you this. And this makes a difference. And here now, when you do it under this real-world probability, which in any case actuarial science is using, and without any measure transformation to some putative risk-neutral measure, there you can capture this. You may have two self-financing portfolios for one and the same payoff, and one only is the martingale, and I call it then this minimal price, and there is then this law of the minimal price, which I will describe. So this is pretty much the story. We will go later in detail. There is a way under the real-world probability, with whatever we see actually there, by using a benchmark, by using this best performing portfolio to hedge into whatever desired payoff we have, so a guaranteed minimum death benefit. And there are many ways of hedging into it. If you are not careful and use investment banking methodology, you hedge perfectly into it, fine. But you might have used a far too expensive pricing process. And there are other ones, and there is one minimal one. You assume you have found the description of the market dynamics, and this minimal one is, of course, which is then the competitive one, because if you have that, use it as a company, then you will just get it right. Maybe you put a small margin for your costs and expenses and business success on top of it. But if you underprice it, okay, then you will lose. If you overprice it, there will be another insurance company who finally uses this kind of technology and will take the customers away from you. So there is a correct price, and this kind of price we need to find. So this was all hand waving just to motivate you, and let's now go a little bit in detail through this. We use this best performing portfolio, and we do not require the existence of a so-called equivalent risk-neutral probability measure. So we don't make these assumptions, and it's very important, because this assumption that I will show you later will stop us to break out of this world of relative pricing, which investment banking tells us we should use. We go into a world of absolute pricing. We compare it with the economy, which is in principle this numerator portfolio, this benchmark, which is a very diversified portfolio in principle. And as I said, we might have significantly lower prices. So let's just keep it all a bit simple and not overdoing it. But here, let's say the units, so the kind of object we like to use in our payoff structure, it may be an index, a very diversified index. Take maybe the S&P 500 index or even the MSCI World Index, so take the whole equity market. So very diversified index. And write its stochastic differential equation down, having here a standard Wiener process. This is another real-world probability, a Wiener process. Here's the volatility. And have more or less is the appreciation rate. And since the insurance company will charge some fees, you just have to subtract it as you go on by just handling this investment into this fund. So we just have to subtract it here in this way. On the other hand, we have a savings account, so it's a proxy for what we can do by going into short-term zero coupon bonds, which we roll over, so day by day. and then RT is a locally riskless interest rate. The key invariant in our market is the market price of risk. And this is what every investor in principle tries to feel and bases decisions on. The market price of risk for that insecurity is then this appreciation rate minus this kind of fee rate, short rate divided over volatility. So by using this, I can rewrite my dynamics from the last slide, just simply so that more or less this return process is a short rate plus the volatility times this market price of risk, and here volatility again times this Wiener process. So if I put these volatilities here outside, then you see there's market price of risk, Wiener process. This is theta TDT, DWT. This would be the differential of a risk neutral Wiener process if you would like to go in this direction. But we don't do that. Just an observation. So then we can form portfolios. And an instantaneous portfolio return will be the fraction invested in, say, a savings account. And here the fraction invested in, say, our index. And this will be the portfolio what we might look at and which we may need, for instance, to hedge, for instance, and puts on the index or a guaranteed minimum death benefit. So, and of course, I can write it in this form, which is then here just our any portfolio we look at in this small world I have here. So the fractions, of course, number of units in savings account over total portfolio value, fractions add up to one. So now I come to the benchmark. Already in this very small market, only two securities, of course, I could identify the benchmark, the numerator portfolio, and I show you just how you get it there. But of course, we have a much, much, much bigger investment universe, and we come later into a little bit other interpretation. So Long in 1990 was the first, more or less, who coined the term numerator portfolio and had it coming up in a paper. And the key observation he made was, if I make this numerator portfolio, what we talk about here, as my numerator, as my reference unit, then the reasonable pricing measure, the pricing probability, and when you take your expectation, is a real world probability. So the one we use in actuarial pricing in other places. So this is key information. So, and then there are other results. Kelly already in 1956 came up with a portfolio, the log optimal or gross optimal portfolio. So the portfolio that maximizes expected utility. And one can show very generally this numerator portfolio is very generally for all models we will be interested in, it is exactly the numerator portfolio. So the gross optimal portfolio and numerator portfolio are the same. So you see already gross optimal portfolio maximizes growth, so expected growth. So it's best in this sense. Numerator portfolio was a portfolio where the returns or the expected returns of benchmark securities were less or equal to zero. So in this way there are two ways of saying best when you have these are two ways, and yes, here now you can do an easy calculation here just to get yourself a little bit of your formulas. Look at the maximum of the expectation of the logarithm of a portfolio. So this is expected log utility, what I'm maximizing here. And this is a simple quadratic optimization problem for the fractions. You can get it out. You will find it's also the Merton problem, if some you know that. It's more or less the market price of risk over volatility tells you how much you invest in this risky index here, in this index, and the rest, of course, in the savings account. And then you find this, after this optimization, the stochastic differential equation for the numerator portfolio. It's just the following: short rate squared market price of risk as risk premium and market price of risk as volatility. So what happens? By going from this general investment universe where anything can happen and drift and diffusion coefficients in your assets, you optimize go to the Numeraire portfolio, this is best performing portfolio, and suddenly you have an object where drift and diffusion coefficient are linked. They're suddenly linked. When you are in a risk neutral world, you have, of course, such a link. The drift is zero and there's a volatility here. But here you see it under the real world probability that there is such a link. And this is very important that you have now a link. By the way, if you would think you have the Numeraire portfolio in your hands, you need just to look at this volatility and you would know what the market price of risk is. Even that you can't estimate the risk premium, which is impossible, you need hundreds of years to do that. But knowing that you are close to the Numeraire portfolio with something tells you also something about the risk premium. So it's best performing, this Numeraire portfolio, in many ways. Yeah, one would be the following, and this is, I think, very interesting. Take the Numeraire portfolio, take the logarithm of this ratio, normalize it over time. This is, in principle, the long-term growth rate if you make time to infinity. This is a number, that a random number that comes out, and you can do it for any other strictly positive portfolio and compare these long-term growth rates. And then there's a theorem, it's just very short proof, and it exploits this kind of super martingale property what I explained. And this tells you this proof, very general, without any further modeling assumptions or so, that the long-term growth rate of the Numeraire portfolio is greater or equal than that of any other strictly positive portfolio. This means, if you wait long enough, the Numeraire portfolio will almost surely, with its one single pass that we experience in our life, will almost surely outperform any other portfolio. That is very important. There is not an expectation here on anything on this. So, and then, which I don't represent here, but you find in my book and in other work, a very good proxy for a Numeraire portfolio is a very well-diversified portfolio. So there's a diversification theorem, which is based on the law of large numbers in some form, which tells you, take small fractions from everything what we can invest in, and then go to infinitely many such constituents in your market. What is happening is all these very diversified portfolios will look very similar. I think anyone who plays with data knows that these very diversified indices look very similar. But not only that, they all converge to the same limit. And this limit is the Numeraire portfolio, under very general assumptions without any need to specify a model. It's just a consequence of the law of large numbers. So that means we have in reality proxies for the Numeraire portfolio. If you want, take the MSCI World Accumulation Index. It is a very, very good proxy already, but there are possibly better ones. So here is, for, say, US market, another proxy, which is really reasonable for the Numeraire portfolio. Take the S&P 500 Accumulation Index, and here is a graph for the discounted index, just discounted by the US dollar savings account. And of course, from 1920 until now, we have this growth. Here was a Great Depression, and you remember these parts, and probably we are somewhere up here now. The logarithm of that graph, it's also very interesting. Look, this was a Great Depression here, and this was a 2000 situation. But what you see is, in the very long term, and if you go back and plot more data, which is a little bit loose, but there are data, and you find that pretty much a growth from 4 to 6% above interest is roughly what, say, the capitalist society in the equity market has experienced, and which is roughly what a good company with a successful, in principle, makes on top after costs and after everything. So, yes, it means roughly there's a fundamental value underlying it, and when we like to model this, then we will need a model which is something different as, say, just Brownian motion with time transformed or so. No, it's a Brownian motion would go all over the place, far away. This is here around some, I would call it, fundamental value type situation. So now let's go for prices. Which prices we can see now in this market? I said there's this very simple result which says all benchmarked portfolios, or yeah, we can add it to price processes, will be super martingales. So when you have benchmarked it, then there is this inequality for, say, a price process or value process or portfolio process, that its current value is greater or equal than expected future values. Good. So we know that. These are super martingales. In the long term, they have no upward trend, roughly speaking. In some sense, this already is enough to give us a notion of what we call that there is no strong arbitrage. So arbitrage is a notion that there are many, many versions in the mathematical literature. And in particular, in modern mathematical finance, there's a very particular notion which is beautiful and gives some equivalence. But I feel, and I write it also in the book, in my papers, I feel it's too strong. It excludes too many models for consideration, in particular those which would allow us to get the equity premium reasonably well into our modeling. But there's no strong arbitrage, and strong arbitrage means pretty much that none of these non-negative super martingales which we may form here with our, say, best processes, none of these can ever, as long as they are non-negative, come out of zero into anything strictly positive. There is no way. So it's a very simple form of arbitrage, and I call it strong arbitrage, which is automatically excluded. So arbitrage, strong arbitrage, is automatically excluded in the whole framework. This means pricing on the basis of arbitrage arguments, this is not enough. It is just too narrow. So that means this will be not an argument for us that we can use hedging arguments, for instance, to price a long-dated security. This is not enough. However, then we have securities in among these super martingales that are these martingales, where the present value is the best forecast of any future benchmark value. So then equality. And we call this fair. Okay, the notion fair is used in many, many ways, but let me call use it also here, and it's fair. This is then, in some way, among these super martingales, one that gives us, in a way, the cheapest way to achieve something, they assume you can replicate it. Let's just look at it here. Have a portfolio, a non-negative, say, fair portfolio, and maybe another non-negative portfolio. Both, say we know, both will replicate this pair of maybe this put or guaranteed minimum death benefit. And the super martingale property will tell us, because of this expectation of this value at the end, that this martingale, this fair one, will be less or equal at this earlier time than values of a, say, super martingale, of a strict super martingale. This is just a consequence of it. Very simple, basic stochastic analysis argument. And this means this martingale solve almost automatically some optimization problem all the time. Yeah. Still, there are other not so optimal solutions. So in this way, the fair prices are minimal prices. And this I call then this, yeah, this context here more or less law of the minimal price. Because we will see for the same payoff, there may be several portfolios, replicating, hedging, self-financing portfolios, where there's only one minimal one, and this is just simply this martingale, and the others exist, and we have to deal with it, and if you are not careful enough, you may end up with some super martingale, which is far more expensive than the martingale if you would have done all these things nicely. And in this world, it's possible, in this benchmark approach, whereas in the classical, now classical, investment banking type pricing, risk neutral pricing, this is not a situation that one is allowing. So here's one example. Think of, and I later will specify it further, think of savings bonds. So assume for the moment we had deterministic US interest rate, and I used that for this period here, and formed a rollover savings account, but gave it so much capital at the beginning that it will give me $1 at the end. This is, you know, one benchmark dollar, because I have everything benchmarked written. Then what I will have a savings account benchmarked. So that means the US dollar savings account divided by the S&P 500. And the S&P 500 is, of course, growing much in the long term much faster than the savings account. It's 5% faster, roughly speaking. So that means in the long term you have a significant trend downwards, and the probability mass where this may be is sitting somewhere down here. At the same time, and this is a self-financing portfolio, because I go into the savings account, roll over, and end up. On the other hand, I can take the expectation of this $1 in units of that S&P 500, just a real-world expectation, and find a value somewhere here. And when I'm then able to build a model that I can even hedge it, I'm done. Then I have a self-financing hedging portfolio, and I call this here then the benchmarked fair zero coupon bond, which gives me also this $1 in units of this numerator portfolio at that future time. And there's a major difference. Both are self-financing, and the question is just how we get that here out. And the thing is, you may then wonder, yeah, how this may be possible. It is really a bit strange and a bit out of what one is used to think. But look, there is a really important difference, and I didn't mention it in my course because it didn't come up, but now I point it out. These securities, they are really different. They are different. And there's a paper by, I think, Tom Salisbury on liquidity premium and things like that. This has to do with liquidity, what I'm doing here. It is the following. This rollover, this savings bond, at any time you can just liquidate it whenever you want. Okay? The fair zero coupon bond is just a deposit. You get it only at the end. And there will be a hedge, and those who replicate it is doing it for you, but he or she or this company has to have the freedom to do what they need to do to achieve it, and it may be a very weird hedge for some periods of time, yes. So this is having no liquidity, and in principle you could think of having this extra here, being able to model some kind of a liquidity premium, or the premium for being able at all the time to access this portfolio value, which you can't hear. Yeah? So my grandfather, yeah, there was nothing in between. But this is a very important kind of situation. So this is, but when you have really a guaranteed minimum death benefit with some maturity, maybe out in 30 years, there is a penalty by the insurance company in any case if you start to liquidate it. Yeah? So they have introduced it. So the pricing formula, the pricing rule that comes now very naturally out is the following. You take your numerator portfolio, your benchmark, so a very diversified portfolio. It could be the S&P 500 as a first proxy. It could be the MSCI World Index as a better proxy. And in some of my papers in the next few months, you find even a much better proxy. But what you do is you take your payoff, benchmark it, take the real-world expectation under the information at the time where you are, at the time t, and multiply it by the value of the numerator portfolio at the time where you are. Because you want to see this expected benchmark value in units of your domestic currency, of course. If I bring this over here in the denominator, then you see really this martingale property clearly. This was what I had before. Then it would have been benchmarked. But now I want to show you this here in domestic currency, so I have to multiply with my numerator at the time where I am. That's, I think, clear. So now risk neutral probability is here needed, and it doesn't need to exist, and I would even say it's very important that we have this freedom to get in the long term effects, for instance, from the existence of the equity premium into our modeling and into then our hedges and all these kind of calculations we want to do. So this is a very general formula. No modeling much, it's just this kind of martingale and super martingale arguments there. And now let's see what we can recover from it. So there is, for instance, the actuarial pricing formula, net present value, which everyone knows and has been used for centuries. But I haven't seen any proof in the literature. It's more like an axiom, more like an assumption, or more like a statement how one should do things. Here you find now a proof in one line. Assume that you pay off, say, my death event, and the financial market, that means this numerator portfolio, this very diversified index, that they are independent. Okay? What can you do? Then you have an expectation of this H times 1 over V star. So this is a product independent. I can just split it up. I have expectation of H times expectation of 1 over V star. But expectation of 1 over V star, expectation of 1 over V star, this is a payoff, $1 in units of the domestic, of the numerator portfolio. This means this is a payoff of a zero coupon bond. So, and then I take what I had before, the V star in front of it. So I get here the fair zero coupon bond price in front of the real world expectation of my payoff. So it's discounting net present value in the way as you always have done it. And it's just a proof coming out of these kind of considerations. Yeah? There is a proof for the actuarial pricing formula in that form. So, but others might see what is the link to risk neutral pricing. And we can do this. Then we have now to explain, of course, things which we use in risk neutral pricing. There's a radon-nicodym derivative. And in a complete market, where everything can be replicated and hedged and so on, it is the benchmark savings account. This is a savings account. This is a benchmark normalized to 1 at the time 0, which is the radon-nicodym derivative of this putative risk-neutral measure. So if you have a complete market, this is what it would be. It's well known. There's no escape from that. But we know that the benchmark savings account is a super martingale. This is just in our setting. It can be a martingale, so it's current value, the best forecast of the future values. But it can also be a strict super martingale, that in the long term it's coming down. The question is, and here mathematics allows you everything to do, but now you have to judge what is an appropriate model. In my judgment, and I show you later graphs, is that in reality, the savings account in units of the S&P 500 seems to trend downwards because of the equity premium. And if I like to capture that, then I cannot make the assumption that I have equality here. What I have in reality is the initial value of this super martingale is greater or equal than its expected future values. And if it is really not a martingale at all, I have only such a relationship that it is greater than that. But this is exactly the assumption where you make here an equality sign and all your analysis and decision making. This is the assumption for this relative pricing, for the risk neutral pricing, which is the current paradigm in investment banking. So, but you can recover, of course, out of this real world pricing formula, the risk neutral pricing formula. What you can do is you take this real world pricing formula, you rewrite this by multiplying and dividing, and find here your radon-nicodym derivative of this putative measure, risk neutral measure. And since there was this inequality, that 1 is greater or equal than the expected later value of this, when I divide by something smaller, I make the whole right hand side here. This is exactly the same as this. I make the whole right-hand side larger. And then you see, the mathematician sees here, by Bayes' rule, I could change my pricing measure to the so-called risk-neutral measure. But only then this is a martingale. But then the expectation of this would have been one, and of course I have the equality. So if you formally start in your calculations, in your evaluation, say, of a guaranteed minimum death benefit, from the assumption there is a risk neutral measure and you do it just under this, you will find a hedge, and the hedge may be perfect and really nice. But you may sit with such a price on the right hand side of this equation, more expensive than necessary. And there is a fair price eventually, there's a fair price, which you can hedge also perfectly, which is much cheaper. And now it's your responsibility to tell your insurance company, or when you are employed in this company, where the fair price really is. Because if you overprice because of following the rules of, say, investment banker who push maybe your whole subprime credit department, then you overprice and you push it into the market. If you're lucky, you have nothing on your accounts anymore when it really comes to the correction, which then has to come when it becomes visible that it was overpriced. But if you have it on your books, then you have a problem. On the other hand, if your company underprices by whatever wrong pricing rule, after a while you will have not sufficient funds to hedge it out, because there was this minimal price, which is the only hedgeable thing, and on average you will also just suffer. So that means there is an economically correct price, and this is the real world price, and I have reasons to say also in an incomplete market this is very clearly also the candidate for an economically correct price. How one could see this, just a short word. If you have a very diversified portfolio of contingent claims, say in an insurance company, like in a reinsurer worldwide, small contributions everywhere, there will be then in your benchmark claim a hedgeable part, which you can hedge by this minimal price, as I explained, so hedge it, and then you will have non-hedgeable parts, okay, like my death and other things eventually. Okay, then you can do in this benchmark world to look at all these hedge errors. And through the real world pricing, these hedge errors, benchmarked from the benchmark hedge errors, have zero mean. And since I hedged already everything what I could hedge, their noise is more or less independent or orthogonal to the noise from the hedgeable things. So the variance what I'm having from the hedge errors is minimal for each of the claims already then. But the thing is, if this book of this insurance company is very diversified, having many different benchmarked hedge errors, then by the law of large numbers, you get from these many independent hedge errors, when you aggregate them with zero mean, you get more or less a total hedge error aggregated, which say in one time step is pretty much zero. And if you have that achieved, you have more or less, from your book perspective as an insurance company or as a large investment bank, you have a complete market almost, because you diversified by pooling all these errors away. Of course, it's well known that one in principle should do that, but here it's coming out very clear, very quantitatively, and we know where to go. So I said already in principle that the long-term trend, when I go over to risk-neutral pricing, which would be this year here with the savings account, there is a danger that I ignore the long-term trend if I just start from this rule and make this my price, because it could be more expensive than necessary. So then long-term trends are also ignored in slightly other versions of relative pricing, which we find. There's a stochastic discount factor approach, deflator approach, pricing kernel, state price density. Also the numerator portfolio is long, in principle, in which framework he presented it, it was still not allowing for what I'm allowing, that there are some strict super martingales coming up. So now let's go into an example. And this was this fair zero coupon bond, which I discussed already in some way. And we will see that, assume no deterministic interest rate, this expectation can be split into two parts. There will be expectation of this, I call it savings bond part, with a short rate. And here's the conditional expectation of the discounted numerator portfolio ratio, which you just have to calculate. And then when you do this for such a case which I indicated here, where the benchmark savings account is trending downward, then yes, you get a much cheaper value here when you take this expectation than what this savings bond more or less was doing. So here is this savings bond, and here's a fair zero coupon bond, and there is a clear in general, a clear inequality. And here is a graph which I have drawn in this way. This is here the benchmark savings account starting at 1, which is this rather nicotine derivative, which I would have to model if I like to do now risk neutral pricing. And I would have to judge whether this is now a martingale or not. If I do relative pricing, risk neutral pricing, or any of the forms which I just showed, then you just assume this, what you see here, is a martingale. That means this value is the best forecast of all these future values, in particular those here. And I think it's a bit much. If you take a model, which I later mentioned, the minimum market model, and just calculate the total risk-neutral mass, if I try to get something like a measure on that, this is at the beginning it's 1, and otherwise later it declines substantially because there is something happening. Good. And then we can calculate here the savings bond or the fair zero coupon bond. Both go into the $1, and you see in the long term, or just coming closer than to maturity, these are very close together. Fine. That means also investment banking for short term horizons is okay. Yeah? But in the long term, it makes a big difference. And you can see this here on that graph. What is happening is, in the long term, this fair zero coupon bond in this log graph, this is a fair zero coupon bond, you follow very much the log of this index, here the S&P 500, and there's a model underlying it. It then slides over into this savings bond, whereas the savings bond all the time invests just in this rollover and has to start much higher to achieve that all. There's a model, the so-called minimum market model, which I'm not explaining too much here, but you find it in my books. It has an explicit transition density, and we can work with it as we do with the Black-Scholes model. It's my workhorse. You get explicit formulas. And this minimum market model. And here is then the explicit formula for fair zero coupon bond. It is the savings bond times 1 minus expression. If this bracket, this round bracket, would be 1, we would be back in risk-neutral relative pricing. But this is coming up. This is from this long-term, this risk premium more or less effect that we get here, this kind of value that brings us down, and this makes a difference. And you will, this is just a zero coupon bond. We can do it also in other securities. Here is, for instance, the investment, the fraction I invest in the savings account when I form the hedge of that fair zero coupon bond. At the very beginning, I have almost all my fractions in the index, so I use the equity premium, this growth of this index, and later, according to a hedge ratio, as in Black-Scholes, I slide over in having everything at the end in the savings bonds. And this is a rule you have to follow, you have to hedge. Good, this is here, the hedge arrow is very small. We will need, when we do guaranteed minimum death benefits, something like a put. Let's take now a put on an index, benchmarked. Here is a price. There's an explicit formula, which will look very familiar to you. It's like Black-Scholes, but now we have another distribution, of course, behind, and the distribution is such that here's the underlying, and this is a non-central Kaiser distribution function, 4 degrees of freedom with some non-centrality parameter and so on, and this is a strike discounted, and here's another distribution function, also non-central Chi-squared, with other features. So you have distribution function coming up. in a very similar way as Black-Scholes. And you can calculate also then, in principle, the hedge ratios and go on. You have put call parity, you have all these things, but not when using a savings bond, you have to use fair zero coupon bonds in your put call parities. So this is a graph which for put is quite interesting, and I have not shown it this morning, for instance. Here, a put is now the following. The first graph up here, this is strike price times a savings account, okay? This next graph here, this dashed line, is a formally calculated risk neutral put. So assume the dynamics, the volatility is all is done correctly, but you invest now in according to this putative risk neutral strategy, which is relative pricing. And you see already it's much more expensive than I will do later, but it follows more or less this at the beginning, but slides later into the correct payoff. Wherever the at the end, then the payoff will be, the put will be right. But there is a fair put, and the fair put does the same thing as a fair zero coupon bond. At the end, it takes its capital, invests it for a long time in the index, and rides on the equity premium as long as it can, and then, of course, according to the mathematically calculated hedge ratio, it finally slides over into the same what this risk neutral put has done. But here, it's a big difference. And here is more or less the kind of thing what motivated me years ago in Bankers Trust, where I said, look, guys, something is wrong. There must be a better way of hedging or getting up with these kind of results. Okay, it was not probably so clear to me. Now let's just then wind it up. Okay, then we can now use all this technology, and this is familiar to the actuaries and for the mathematicians. I don't need to explain much. You can then have a policyholder where there is some kind of a guarantee. This is like a growth of some initial wealth and some other payoff structure. It could be that this was in the index, and then you get in principle the whole thing rewritten in such a form where there's a maximum of such things. I'd like just to come to the point, this is not here, this is a payoff then for this guaranteed minimum death benefit, but here I see when I rewrite it, here sits my put. I just need to apply what I have explained before, and everyone can in principle do that. So, and then you go through it, you calculate it all out, and here is what we have done with the Munich Re people. If I use my so-called minimal market model, which was behind the graphs and the hedges which I showed you, where I know the transition density, which has the super martingale property, and have now extra G in my, the extra growth in my reference capital in my payoff structure, then for times to maturity long, yes, the prices are relatively low, and this is a typical dependence of prices on maturity. If I give it a bit more growth rate, these things decline faster. If I go and use not this kind of minimal price, this fair price, what I have shown you on a real world pricing, if I use now risk neutral, which is more expensive, then you see it here, what's happening. This risk neutral pricing, by using the same volatility assumptions and so on, then you get this kind of higher, and if you have even a growth, then it becomes really more larger. This is just matching the scores to something. So what is here? There's a technology out and now out and used by some companies where cheaper, long-dated securities can be priced and hedged.